we have this funny sense of generations, because I think, you know, some of the people sitting here, we're not that far apart in age, but the way a New York generation seems to line up with a decade, and also when you came to New York. So somebody who's only 5 years older than you seems to be 10 years older than you because they were here in the 60s. So it's sort of like, I mean, I kind of feel like the 70s of New York, of this institution, sort of kind of coming into, I don't know if power would be the word in relationship to poetry, but in the 80s, you know, and like Ed said, you know, like the neighborhood was utterly changing in the 80s, because when I moved to the neighborhood, you could get an apartment for $115, and that's why I moved to this neighborhood, because all the poets were here. So, and also by the 80s, there was a way in which poetry, which seemed so hip and cool in the 70s, was no longer fashionable. You know, it was performance art. And so, and this institution wasn't so new, and PS 122 was really new. So all, it seemed like all the press, it seemed like performance art seemed to be stealing poetry's thunder. And so that was part of what the world of my directorship was. So I think a lot of what... And also the art world. There was so many galleries in this neighborhood. There was so much money. There was so much cocaine. There was so much, you know, kind of fast living and limos. It was just this moment that was kind of unbelievable. And, you know, a lot of, you know, restaurants selling, you know, margaritas on Second Avenue. And just kind of, there was this drunkenness in the neighborhood. And it really was very funny to say you were a poet at this time. So I guess I would think part of my driving vision was to, you know, occupy the place where I had kind of come up and kind of rethink it from that position. And I think everybody was aware of, I mean, there was a sense... To be part of this institution, I think, was to be in conversation with people who would say, oh, you're part of that boys' scene at St. Mark's. So though I think everybody was aware of the fact that the scene always needed to be more female-driven, more feminist-driven, more person of color-driven, more queer-driven. All those things were happening, you know, in waves. But I think because Patricia and I were, because Patricia was the first person of color who was working here, you know, and as program coordinator, and because I was the first lesbian director, you know, I think we had a very strong agenda. So there was kind of a, I felt like experienced it as sort of a generational takeover, you know, which it was and it wasn't. You know, I mean, interestingly, I remember having lunch with Ron before I had the job, and the project was going through incorporation at that time, and I was the person who was director during that. And I remember Ron saying, don't make the artist board be the board of directors. That will be a problem. And I was like, these are my friends. How could that possibly be a problem? It was a huge problem. It was a nightmare. You know, and you know, I won't talk about that right at this moment, but later on, you know. But so there was a lot of, you know, so it was like the institute, it was almost like a club becoming, I felt like it was a club becoming an institution. And some of that was legal, which meant certain things that were, you know, like, so friendships were empowered, and you know, like, I was the board of directors suddenly, but the people who were on the artist board had votes and had power over me in a way that was sort of astonishing. And I was sharing information with people who were old friends and thinking this would facilitate things, and sometimes it did, and sometimes it made a total nightmare. So I feel like the place was massively in transition when I was here. And so it was fun. I mean, so the gang of people who, you know, so it was myself and Patricia. Tim Dugos was the newsletter editor initially. And Charles Bernstein brought what he called the New York Talk Series into the project. And there was an amazing historic series of talks. There had been a talk series when Ron was here, and I guess, you know, when I think about the guy who I sort of couldn't stand who ran the series, I think he used my poems to illustrate what was wrong philosophically in poetry at one of his talks, so I didn't like this man at all. But Charles brought a whole other very clear agenda, you know, which was great, and actually, you know, I still reference many of the things I heard in those talks for years, but also felt very, you know, like it was very extremely language poet focused, which I felt like was sort of narrow. So it was, you know, like hiring the perfect people and then seeing that they, you know, we were all people and that we weren't perfectly happy with everybody's aesthetic. Chris Krauss and Mark ran the performance series, but then later in the time I was here, Richard Elovich ran it, and he brought performance art. I mean, you know, again, I think if you looked at earlier, you know, like in New York history, performance art was here from the beginning because there was, I think the kitchen, I don't have the timeline of New York institutions, but, you know, like the Poetry Project was one of the places where performance art could happen. But I think increasingly it became a poetry space, so Richard was really very close and involved with PS122, so Karen Finley performed here, and, you know, a huge number of people who had actually never been in this space. So that was very exciting. But all of these things were really political. There were big fights, you know. It was sort of like suddenly the Monday Night Series wasn't having any poets, and people were really mad, or people would actually say there were too many queers reading here. I mean, I remember Tim actually did an issue of the newsletter that had paintings of various friends of his, and people were outraged because they were all fags, you know. So there was a discourse that was great and not always pleasant, you know. But I think the place incorporated. I think maybe the newsletter already wasn't Mimeo, but I felt very much a part of that decision. I think we actually tried to make people pay at the door, you know, and it was so funny because I had cruised in here for years, would never pay to go to a poetry reading. And suddenly sitting upstairs and looking at the budget, I was like, that's crazy. Everybody would pay for a movie. Why won't they pay for a poetry reading? And really there were like fights at the door, and we gave up, you know, and I can't remember if membership already existed when Bernadette was here, but membership became, we didn't, workshops, which I had gone to for free, became part of the membership plan. If you became a member, you got to go to workshops for free, which meant, in effect, that workshops, I mean, I'm sure anybody could do anything then or now for free still, but it seemed like the idea was to actually make money off our programs, you know. A big thing that happened when I was here was the NEA cut us by $30,000, which was a total nightmare. And I feel like my favorite thing that happened when I was here was we had an amazing art auction and over there, which just brought to my mind, you know, like just an astonishing array of people and furs and you know, an auctioneer from Sotheby's, and it was just it was amazing to hear an auctioneer in that room. So I guess that was. We had Wendell Berry and John Ash as our funny reading. You know, I was like, will they get? I mean, John Ashbery, and I'm not sure if anybody. Maybe I bet those two did, but I don't know if anybody else did. So I think that might be all. We haven't got to the vivid experiences
yet. We'll get there. We'll get to vivid. I can't wait to hear the vivid.
Really?
So I'm gonna read Anselm's response. I had more of a walking vision, walk into the job and walk out of it 4 years later. Both movements being useful to the place, I did everyone a favor by taking the job and I did everyone a bigger favor by leaving. In between, the more useful things that happened were shortening the workday in the office, completing the sale and transfer of the project archive to the Library of Congress, hiring Stacy, convincing the board to let me replace all of the computers, somehow pulling off a few successful silent art auctions, and writing all of my Wednesday intros between 6 and 8 on Wednesdays. It's probably familiar to all of us here. And a lot of terrific readings. I didn't want to alter what the project had been doing artistically so much as I wanted to extend it a little bit and rearticulate its commitment to smelly downtown poets of varying artistic stripes who were at least trying to make it work. Wait, I mean smellier uptown poets? Sort of. Or, I mean, it was just time for the project to wear some tighter pants and for everyone inside and out to stop pretending they really knew anything about each other. Constant surveillance, without rigor, naturally, makes you think you know something. A deeper enigma, and not anyone's idea of one, but something live, was what I was after. Along with not fucking it up. Or maybe just fucking it up enough to make it interesting. Okay. Share one of the most vivid experiences during your directorship. There's another one that's going to come last season, attendance at readings.
Vivid. Okay. There's so many. There's the being up in the office of the parish hall, a long night at the Mimeo machine. It was dawn of Thanksgiving, and I tripped the wire. We've been mimeographing up there, and I tripped the wire, and the church was wired with Pinkerton men who would come on alarm would go off. They'd get a signal, and there was a complicated system of this thread. I think it was actually was it a wire?
A tripwire.
It was a tripwire. In any case, I tripped the wire, and within minutes, I walked out, and there was a gun at my head. And it was the same night, I think, as the there was an offering of a deer that it was hanging on one of the trees in the yard. It was a. And I didn't know what to make of it. Was it a negative situation, or was it? Did they really think that the people at the Poetry Project could trust a deer for Thanksgiving and skin it? And it was very mysterious. But there had been grave robberies and a lot of theft of equipment and typewriters and that sort of thing. So this was sort of a necessary precaution. But it was very hard for those of us who were working into the night and burning the midnight oil. Then I have to mention the Kenneth Koch, because it was also a gun. The Kenneth Koch ritual assassination with Alderman Newkirk. It was the height of the events at Columbia, the revolution student sort of, what year was that?
68.
And Andrei Kudrzewski was involved. He was in the back of the room handing out some kind of manifesto, and Alderman Newkirk came down the aisle in a trench coat with out of here, yeah. You're right. Right, he came out of here. And Kenneth was in the middle of reading a poem called To My Audience and was visibly shaken up. I'm not sure, Ron is better with the details, but I do know that I ended up at a bar drinking a lot with Kenneth after this event. And another one was similar sort of intervention or something violent happening was Eileen Carr, the model for Kerouac's character, one of the characters, Tristessa? No.
No.
No, I'll think of it. Anyway, she, I think it's in the Subterranean, she was very angry at Alan for taking her husband Lucian away on some trip, and she showed up on a bicycle and started to come down the aisle to attack Alan. Alan was getting attacked a lot in public in those days. There was a woman with a lot of Medgar Evers buttons and multiple shirts who was dogging him around, and there had been an incident in Columbia. But anyway, Eileen came up and had to be held down by the poet guys. I remember it was about eight guys she was so angry at Alan. So the interventions and so many vivid readings. One of my favorites was Charles Reznikoff, and Ron actually helped track him down, and it was like this reclamation. We felt we had, found him and brought him into this public space. It was an absolutely beautiful reading and extraordinary to get to know him. And he subsequently came out to Naropa and so on. So it was that was a very vivid night. I hope it's on the documents, on the tape. Is it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
No, that was a tape
That was lost. It's stolen.
Yeah, borrowed.
By TB?
I think so.
Ted Berrigan, when you were missing a tape. And then, I'll stop there. There are many, 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 many occasions. A vivid memory.
Oh, I have one. I was trying to get the people at the Poetry Project were selling heroin at the readings or in the church, so I was trying to get them to stop. So I asked this one guy who I knew was doing it to meet me for a drink at the Ukrainian restaurant. So he came over, and we had a drink, and we were both being very polite, and he put his hands on the table, and very pointedly, but without saying anything, he made me notice that one of his fingers had a piece missing.
And so he continued?
Yes.
Selling heroin? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, no, he stopped selling heroin.
You weren't intimidated?
Yeah. I thought it was kind of funny, actually. I should have been, but yeah, no, I wasn't at all. I thought it was like one of those TV shows, you know.
Oh, I stopped Andrea Dworkin, the radical feminist, from bringing a huge riot of radical feminists to boycott the William Burroughs reading. That was a very good one.
Oh,
I know.
Ron.